Kevin Barrett. The new guest telling hard truths 4 or 5 times a week, maybe even more than that. You get sometimes as many as 6 or 7 guests per week telling you things you're never going to hear in the corporate mainstream. Well, today we're going to talk about maybe the best chance we have of blowing 9/11 wide open in the political system. And that is the presidential candidacy of Rand Paul. Rand Paul recently called a press conference and announced that he is introducing a bill in the Senate that matches the one in the House to declassify the 28 top secret pages of the Joint Congressional Inquiry into 9/11. This allegedly details support of the Saudi alleged hijackers by Saudi Arabia. The money would have been coming through the Saudi embassy in Washington, D.C., run by, guess who, Mr. Bandar Bush, a made man in the Bush crime family. So if this all comes out, it could start to peel back the layers of the onion, reveal the activities of the alleged hijackers, who were actually patsies. They were CIA agents brought into the U.S. on CIA snitch visas and put through the motions to set them up as the patsies to be blamed for 9/11. And that could pretty well blow our whole political system wide open. The powers that be aren't going to want this to happen. Rand Paul is playing with dynamite. And my guest, Rolf Lindgren, is a Rand Paul fan as well as a James Madison and Galileo scholar. Let's find out what Rolf thinks. Rolf, is Rand Paul going to bring down the house of cards of today's American post 9/11 political system?
Well, I think that if those 28 pages get released, that's going to be a huge blow to the neocons, because essentially it means we invaded the wrong country, and the people who led the invasion knew about it in advance. And so that's a pretty damning. Of course, we know those were patsies, but if you take a step aside, whether they were patsies or they were the actual hijackers, it doesn't make any difference either way. That obviously, if Saudi Arabia funded those people, then why did we invade Afghanistan and then Iraq?
Well, people have been asking that for quite some time. But see, I think this is aimed at Jeb Bush, Rolf, frankly, because Jeb Bush is up to his eyeballs in the 9/11 cover-up. He was the one who flew to the fake flight schools in Florida that were, you know, they were supposedly flight schools where these alleged hijackers were pretending to learn to fly, but they were actually CIA drug import airstrips. And within 24 hours of 9/11, Jeb Bush led a contingent of FBI agents and Florida National Guard into those so-called flight schools and confiscated all records. He even stole all of the police files on those flight schools. And there had been huge police files because they actually got busted smuggling a vast amount of heroin. So Bush, he's up to his eyeballs in this. And Rand Paul, I think, is kind of throwing a little preemptive strike, Jeb Bush's way. So there's a kind of a political game going on here, but it could get pretty nasty. I would be a little concerned about Rand's security right now.
I wouldn't be, because, first of all, I don't think Jeb Bush is, even if they don't release this, I don't think that Jeb Bush is going to stand a ghost of a chance. I think his poll numbers are going to collapse in sometime between September and November, when people start paying attention in the fall after Christmas or summer's over. His poll numbers will collapse. He'll be dropped out of the race, probably, maybe sooner than we think, but certainly by November or December, I don't think he'll be even running anymore. As far as the papers, I know a lot of people already say we know that this, we know that. The fact is, if these documents are released and they say what we think they're going to say, that Saudi Arabia funded the accused hijackers, it makes it like a concrete thing more than just like a whisper campaign. It's more of like, this is a fact, and it can't be, even the mainstream media would have to acknowledge that. And there may be powerful people in the government who are sick of all the wars. They may think it's bad for the U.S. anyway. There's probably a lot of billionaires who don't agree with the wars. We always think that the billionaires always support the wars, but there's probably a lot of billionaires who don't support the wars, at least right now. So
these wars haven't done us a whole lot of good, have they? I mean, they were supposed to give us really cheap gasoline and revive our economy and give Iraq a happy democracy of pro-Israel, all this kind of nonsense. And obviously, none of that happened. These wars are so unpopular. And Jeb Bush is going to have all those negatives from the fallout of the wars that his brother started.
Well, he's already, yeah. I mean, this would just be another nail in the coffin. I mean, we'll see what plays out. The reports, the government reports of how much money these candidates have raised. There's all these stories about how Jeb Bush is going to raise $100 million, and they're saying that Rand Paul is falling behind in fundraising. I don't know if that's really true or not. I haven't seen any reports since last year. I think the reports are due by July 15th. The first reports of what these super PACs are actually raising. So, until I see some real numbers, it's just a bunch of talk. And I don't think all the money in the world can get Jeb Bush through the primary. I just don't think, I think there's just too many people that don't like him, and there's too many people in the Republican primary that don't agree with him on key issues, including Common Core. And he seems to be pretty pro amnesty for illegal aliens, and I'm not saying that I'm against illegal aliens, but I think that the voters in the primary aren't gonna, it's a big problem for him in the primary, I think, to go too far on this immigration reform, because a lot of people think that, people who come over here and then they get welfare benefits and stuff, and they're not even U.S. citizens. Some people don't really like that too much,
Of course, the other side
So.
of that is in the general election, Jeb Bush being sort of pro-immigrant and speaking Spanish could be a big boost because he could grab a little bit of that Hispanic vote that
He'll
mostly goes to
never get to the
Democrats.
he'll never get to the general election, so I wouldn't worry about it.
Yeah.
I think he's just running right now. He right now his name is out there. He's raising, if he's, I'm sure he's raising a lot of money. Why not raise a lot of money and then put it in a bank account, and then he'll have a super PAC that he can be a player with in the future, after he drops out. I think he's just trying to cash in as much money as he can, and then he's going to sit back. Although I have heard he's also running a like a welfare department for ex-neocon political consultants, because according to my story, my information, he's been hiring way too many political consultants. It's sort of like what Hillary Clinton did, if you recall, when she ran against Obama back 8 years ago. She hired way, she was hiring, one guy got paid like $10 million to be a consultant or
For all the good it did
something.
her.
Yeah. And I think what I, according to my sources, Jeb Bush is spending a lot of money on political consultants. So maybe this is just a front to so some of these political consultants can make some money right now, while his name is still, at least he's still viable as a potential candidate, and so that until his poll numbers collapse, people will still, write checks to the Bush people, thinking he might have a chance at being president. So maybe that's what he's doing too. So I don't know what he's really doing exactly. Maybe he's still trying to push the neocon agenda. I suppose that he's doing that. I don't know what he's trying to do exactly. I just don't. The top candidates, in my opinion, are going to be Rand Paul. And then the establishment candidates will be Marco Rubio and Scott Walker. Those are the candidates you have to worry, if you're
And
worried
so, and
about.
you're putting your money on Scott Walker.
I'm not putting my money on Scott Walker, but I'm telling you that if Rand Paul doesn't get the nomination, it's probably going to be Scott Walker or Marco Rubio. Those are the other two top candidates, especially if Bush fades out, their support his supporters will. Well, many of them will shift to Rubio and Walker.
So, do you think that
That's
Rand
what's going
Paul
to happen.
actually has a chance? Of course, Rand Paul represents a line of thinking that's, more clear in the case of his father, but it's a very, non-establishment line of thinking. Some would even say that Rand Paul is challenging the New World Order. Can somebody like that actually win?
I think he can win. I mean, it's the New World Order doesn't stay the same forever. I mean, every so often, someone beats the New World Order, and this could be the time. Rand Paul has two secret weapons. One of the secret weapons he has is he's smarter than everybody else. He's
In the
certainly much
Republican Party,
smarter
that's
than
not
Rubio.
that hard.
Yeah, well, he's certainly smarter than Rubio and Walker.
That's really not that hard.
And then when I say smarter, I don't just mean I don't just mean smarter in the sense that he's smarter. I mean, he's also more knowledgeable on the issues. He's a quicker thinker on his feet. He's better at thinking long-term, short-term strategy, things like that. He's also, his other secret weapon is more people agree with his positions than don't. And one of the areas where Rand Paul has diverged from the average Republican, it's always a position that has two factors. One, it's popular, and two, it's less government.
You know, I actually like the text of his Stand with Israel Act, which purports to be a pro-Israel bill that recently failed. I was explaining this to Jim Fetzer on the air today. You know, Jim was all upset about how the Stand with Israel Act was, you know, was so pro-Israel. Rand Paul was a Zionist, and I explained that, well, actually what that does is it cuts off aid to the Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority is, they're basically the pawns of Israel. The last thing the Israelis want is for the Americans to stop paying for the Palestinian Authority to be the stooges of Israel. So,
Well, Rand Paul's been actually authoring Stand with Israel Acts, Stand with Israel Bills, Stand with Israel Amendments for years. And of course, every time he issues a Stand with Israel bill, it's always opposed by Israel, and it's always opposed by the Zionists, and it's always opposed by AIPAC every time.
Which so tells you something.
It could be a hint. And I did speak with Jim earlier today, Jim, our beloved Dr. James H. Fetzer, and we had lunch today, and he did mention that he was discussing it with you on the show earlier today, and then you guys ended up coming to an agreement on that. So it looks like you guys are waking up. The sheeple are starting to wake up.
Well, you know, I still don't appreciate the pro-Zionist rhetoric coming out of Rand Paul. But, you know, with the people playing the political game at that level, I guess, you know, can't just afford to be honest the way we are here on Truth Jihad Radio.
Well, I think what he's saying is he's standing with the average rank-and-file person rather than the government. The government in Israel is no different than here. We have good people in the United States. We have some of the people have woken up, and some of the people are sheeple, but most of the people are good people, and then we have a bad government at the top, and that's the way it is all over the world in many places, in most places, including Israel.
Well, Israel not so much, Rolf. I mean, there's a structural problem in Israel where, you know, they're not considered legitimate by any of the people in the region. And they, you know, they're an aggressor state. They're basically people that just invaded and occupied a territory that wasn't theirs and committed genocide.
Most of the people who live in Israel didn't invade anything. Most of the people who live in Israel,
right? But they're living with historical consequences.
If we invaded the land of the Indians or something, we invaded it from the Indians or something.
Right, right. You know? But see, imagine, Rolf, if let's say, you know, the United States consisted of the state of, I don't know, the state of New York, and the rest of North America was all Indian. And the Indians said, "The hell with this state of New York, where, you know, that was our sacred land, and we're, you know, you're not legitimate." You know, then the people in New York would likely become, you know, very rabidly, you know, racist and expansionist and genocidal and all of that. Just like settler colonials everywhere in Algeria, the French colons were brutal. They murdered more than 1 million Algerians before they finally left. South Africa, the Afrikaners got pretty brutal there towards the end. Rhodesia, even worse. British Kenya. Every place where there have been European settler colonialists going someplace where the natives didn't just die off of diseases, you've had this issue, this problem, and the settler colonials become ultra-racist, filled with hate, with a superiority complex. And, you know, people like Gilad Atzmon would say it's even worse with these Jewish settler colonialists for various cultural regions associated with the Jewish community. So the people of Israel, 80%, Rolf, 85%, actually almost all
indigenous slavery.
All the Israeli Jews have supported these recent massacres in Gaza. Virtually every single Jew in Israel, with a very few noble exceptions, supported these horrific massacres of women and children and white phosphorus massacres in Gaza. So there's a real problem with
ordinary
people.
Why does everybody have to fight each other? Why are they doing that?
Well, because the Palestinians are fighting for survival against genocide and to some extent for justice.
Why does everybody have to be labeled into a group, though? I guess I don't understand why aren't all people part of the human race?
Well, that's exactly the point of the.
So why does everybody have to be identify with a group?
Well, there you go. That's why all, you know, those of us who support the Palestinians would like to see a sort of an equal protection clause in what's now called Israel, which would say that everybody is equal. That's what we're asking for. Is everybody should be legally equal?
James Madison's ideas have never gotten really caught on in the Middle East, where you have separation of church and state, where the people have their own religion and that's an individual thing, and then the government doesn't have a religion. They just kind of do basic functions like operating a court system and, you know, things like that. That's how the Founding Fathers set up the United States, and obviously that hasn't caught on everywhere else.
Yeah, a lot of what's now the Arab Middle East, most of that was part of the Ottoman Empire until the Ottoman Empire was destroyed by the Rothschild New World Order with their orchestrated world wars. And under the Ottoman Empire, the local people had a tremendous amount of self-determination. There was a millet system, so each group got to determine their own affairs.
So everything was just great during the Ottoman Empire. What about the siege of Vienna in, 1673 or something? There was one in 1517, and there was another one in, 1683 or something. Everything was just great.
It was Europe's misfortune not to have become Muslim, not only at those points, but also earlier in the 800s, when the Spanish Muslims and the various kinds of Europeans were fighting. There was a point where it looked like the Spanish Muslims were going to be making enough inroads into Europe that Europe would become Muslim. And many Western historians today admit that Europe would have been a lot better off if it had become Muslim. It would have been a much more enlightened, less superstitious, more educated, informed polity. It would have been part of a one-world system around the Mediterranean. We wouldn't have needed Galileo because there would have never been a church persecuting people.
Didn't know that the Islamic Renaissance occurred long before Galileo, and they know they were regressing away from Galileo's ideas by the time Galileo came along.
Well, there've never been persecutions of scientists in the Islamic world equivalent to in the Western world.
There's never been any ostracized philosophers then?
They're heretics and dissidents everywhere, but the scientists have not gotten persecuted in the Islamic world because the Islamic world is much more, let's say, less rigidly dogmatic. It lives with other religions. That's why all of these Muslim countries have Christian groups, minorities that have lived there, Jewish minorities. And today, one of the tragedies is that with the European conquest of the world, which has shattered these societies, they've become open to all kinds of actually modern ideas, modern Western ideas of basically totalitarianism. And so we've got this totalitarian pseudo-Islam, the extreme Salafi types who are chasing the Christians out of these countries and persecuting people who don't think like them. That's totally un-Islamic. That's the way the Christians always used to behave.
Yeah. What about all the colonial overlords who got rid of slavery in indigenous societies and also increased rights for women?
Well, we have to grant them that.
The colonial overlords had more rights for women and slavery was still, even in Africa, they still had slavery in the 20th century. And only it wasn't for the colonial overlords who got rid of it that may still be there today.
That's right. The British and, to some extent, the puritanical types from New England basically abolished slavery. The British Navy abolished slavery. So, yeah, let's give the British some credit for that. Of course, you know, there are different kinds of slavery. There are the most horrific forms of chattel slavery, and there are other forms of slavery in which the slave is basically just a member of the family, but the one with the lowest status. And in Islam, the slaves are always supposed to be freed, especially if they accept Islam. They can, typically they would save up enough money. They would run their own, slaves would run their own businesses. They would often amass fortunes. They would often basically take over from their masters.
The Mamluks, the Sahara dynasty, was a slave dynasty. The Middle Ages were marching the slaves across the Sahara Desert, and most historians actually conclude that there were more slaves captured by the Muslims in their era of power than the Europeans took over to the New World. I think there was 15 million people were taken since around 1500 by the Europeans. And according to the research I've been able to do, it's more than 15 million were taken by the Muslims in prior year between the time of Muhammad till the dawn of the era of Columbus.
Well, that's very possible because the Muslims were such a high
because all of them died and they were dying on the
civilization. Civilization has been synonymous with slavery, Rolf, as I'm sure you know, and all complex societies up until very recently throughout history have always had slavery. And the Muslim societies were the biggest ones then. One third of the world's population was Muslim just, 500, 600, 700 years
ago. That's why all this crap about arguing like this is stupid, and that's why I think we need to, first of all, we need someone like Rand Paul who's going to kind of get out of the group think where everybody's in a group. And someone who kind of just says the government will do basic functions and then everyone else is free to live their own lifestyle however they want to.
That's a lot like the Ottomans.
Who?
The Ottomans.
The Ottomans, really? They were like that?
Yeah, that's why the Jews and the different persecuted Christian groups sort kept fleeing to the Ottoman territory.
Like when they were the siege of Constantinople was just like that in 14.
Well, no, obviously the Ottomans, like every other polity, were a big dynasty. You know, they had a monarchy
and an aristocracy.
Yeah, they had a caliphate, and they also had this millet system, so that each group got to run its own affairs, and that's what made it so tempting for the persecuted Christians and Jews of Western Europe to flee to the Ottoman lands to avoid persecution. The Ottomans would basically let them run their own affairs, and I think that's kind of the libertarian philosophy in a sense because a libertarian philosophy doesn't necessarily have to be completely individualistic. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to say that all individuals have to be, you know, completely sovereign and not allow their community to have any rules. Rather, a real libertarian would allow each community to have its own rules.
Well, that's why I like Rand Paul's philosophy, because he's a little bit more, you know, more pragmatic than, say, a pure philosopher. And he's pretty pragmatic on things. And what you're saying, you know, the libertarian philosophy may be in theory a great thing. But we're not, until we get closer to the theory, we need to focus on, you know, a society. I think we've discussed this maybe off the air, but the gross national product of this country only spent 2% of it on the federal government before 1913. 2%.
Now
we're running 25%.
How much?
About 25%.
25%. Yeah, and if it keeps getting much higher, it's hard to imagine where we'll be. Well, Rolf, we haven't talked about
the
Democratic side yet.
Like it is in Europe. Oh, the Democrats.
Yeah.
Oh,
what about Hillary? And who do you think is going to get the Democratic nomination and why?
Martin O'Malley will be the Democratic nominee.
Martin O'Malley.
I've been saying this for over a year now.
And nobody else has ever heard of Martin O'Malley except for you. No, tell us about why you think that.
I heard of him a long time ago because I saw him in a War of 1812 documentary.
Well, didn't the Bilderberg say that O'Malley's going to be their man?
I was just joking about that, but I can infer. I'm pretty sure that he's going to be the nominee. I'm pretty sure.
Okay, well, so how's Hillary going to collapse? She's got all this momentum. She's got money.
She's got a lot of baggage. Well, look, if you were in the Bilderberg group, would you want to have to spend all your time defending her? I mean,
well, even though I'm not in the Bilderberg group, I still wouldn't want to have to spend time defending Hillary.
Well, I mean, first of all, the other candidate who could be tough would be Elizabeth Warren, because she's basically a fake version of Bernie Sanders. She's like Bernie Sanders, except for she likes bailouts and doesn't want to audit the Fed. And as soon as Hillary drops out, she'll jump in and fill the void. So it'll come down possibly to Elizabeth Warren and Martin O'Malley. I just think Martin O'Malley. I think he's going to get it, though.
So what odds are the Las Vegas guys like Sheldon Adelson putting on the O'Malley candidacy? You could probably make some big money here, Rolf, if you were
probably
a gambling 20
man. 20 to 1, 30 to 1.
Really?
Like
20?
That.
Wow. So you heard it here first, folks. If O'Malley gets the nod, Rolf Lindgren called it.
Oh, yeah. I could tell you right now. I could narrow it down. I mean, O'Malley, I would say O'Malley is the best, most likely, and then the secondary pick, we'd want to go with Elizabeth Warren. For Republicans, I guess I would go with Rand Paul, Rubio, or Walker. Would probably be the most likely one of those three.
Well, I'm sure many of my listeners are relieved to hear this, because this Clinton-Bush thing is really getting pretty old. It's funny, both these, you know, Clinton and Bush both have so much negative baggage, so you may be right. They might both collapse.
I got the odds right here.
Okay.
Okay, Republican nomination, Bush is 2-1, so don't bet on him. Rubio is 10-3.
Mm-hmm.
Walker is 7-2, and Rand Paul is 9-1.
Hmm.
So
you actually you're betting on dark horses.
Well, he's not really a dark horse. He's actually the fourth most likely, according to the odds makers.
And the polls seem to show he does better against Democrats than any of the other Republicans.
He's by far the Quinnipiac battleground state poll, which polled Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, general election poll, Rand Paul was the best out of state candidate for the Republicans in all three states, and this isn't the first time this has happened. This has been going on for months. He was also the top candidate in other battleground states like Iowa, Colorado, and Nevada.
And yet the media sometimes blacks him out. We've seen examples of Fox News putting up the Republican contenders and their poll numbers, and they don't even put Rand Paul up there.
The media, right? Well, the media has sophisticated ways of marginalizing candidates, and their latest thing is they say there's three top tier candidates. They say it's Bush, Walker, and Rubio, and they don't have Rand Paul listed as a top. I don't know why he's not the top tier candidate. He's just as good. He's a better. I mean, Rand Paul is doing everything he needs to do to be the president. He's putting together all the pieces. He's hitting every constituency. By the way, I have the polls on the odds on the Democratic nomination.
Mm-hmm.
Martin O'Malley is 16-1. Bernie Sanders is 12-1. Far as like if I had to vote, I would vote for Bernie Sanders. I don't think he will ever get the nomination in the Democratic Party. Clinton is 1-7, so I would not bet on that. And then Elizabeth Warren is still sitting at 25-1. That would be worth a few dollars. And then Joe Biden is at 20-1. And I think Joe Biden is like he's kind of like the Tom Barrett of the national politics. He's kind of like the bad stalwart, the establishment guy that in case we can't find anybody else, at least we'll have an establishment guy. So if something happens to Martin O'Malley and Elizabeth Warren, you know, when I say something will happen, I mean like a scandal or whatever, a health something or who knows what. If something happens to those establishment candidates, at least they'll have trusty Joe Biden to carry the torch.
Trusty Joe Biden. Well,
they certainly don't want Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. I think Bernie Sanders and Rand Paul are probably the ones that the establishment is looking askance at this point. Well, hey, Rolf, I appreciate your prognostication skills.
Rolf, they call me Rolfstradamus. Just call me Rolfstradamus.
Rolfstradamus. Okay. Well, Rolfstradamus, we'll have you back somewhere down the line as this all starts to shake out. But I appreciate all of your insights and your acumen, your scholarship on James Madison Galileo, and all of your great information on Rand Paul and related matters. Let's hope that Rand Paul blows 9/11 wide open and gets a mandate to make some big changes.
Rand Paul will release those secret documents on 9/11. If it isn't done by Obama, Rand Paul will do it when he assumes the presidency in 2017.
Sounds like
but
a plan.
But we need your support.
I love it. All right. Thank you, Rolf Lindgren. See you around.
You're welcome, Dr. Ferris. Bye.
Welcome back to Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, talking electoral politics right now with local folks from the Madison, Wisconsin area where I hang out. We just got done with Rolf Lindgren, the libertarian Rand Paul fan, and now we're going to move over to Dr. Peace. That's Bob Rochline of RealEconomy.com. Dr. Bob has been a kind of left-leaning and Democratic Party kind of guy for all these years, although now there's a big thing on the internet saying he's a communist. We'll get into that later. Anyway, Bob is pretty savvy politically. He's also done very interesting research into issues like the way that the military spending kills economies, and also the cycles, these cyclical aspects of history that may be related to solar radiation and hot and cold periods So let's start out with the presidential race. Bob, welcome to Truth Jihad Radio. How are you?
Hi, you're doing pretty good. I also like low military spending candidates like Rand Paul.
Yeah, so we're on the same page with Rolf on that one. Well, Rolf says that he thinks Rand Paul and Marco Rubio and Scott Walker all are have a pretty good chance for the Republican nomination. On the Democratic side, he actually likes O'Malley, Martin O'Malley. He thinks that Hillary's doomed, Jeb's doomed. Frankly, I think he might have a little bit too much faith in the intelligence of the average American voter. What do you think?
Well, I think Hillary is not doomed at all. I think she's still got the upper hand because she's run once before. Candidates that run once before are worth about 4 points more or a net of 8 points over their opponent in a general election. That's a big advantage, and it's also a big advantage in the primary. So I think she'll hang on and get both of those, maybe 10-point victories in both ways, you know, if she does have a big challenge. But I don't see the Maryland guy giving the big challenge. I think Sanders might.
Well, that would be great. I mean, we all like Bernie Sanders. Rolf's point, though, yeah, I think is an interesting one, that we have, you know, a Clinton. You know, we already had a Clinton dynasty once. We have a Bush. We've had two Bush dynasties. And both Hillary and Jeb do have relatively high negatives. I think Jeb maybe even more because of the disastrous Iraq war his brother started. So we have these two, you know, candidates with high name recognition because, you know, people with the same name have been president. And they both have pretty high negatives. It seems to me there's a chance that if the economy stays as bad as it is, that people might not want these, you know, they might not want another Bush or another Clinton kind of thing. They might go for something fresh. I don't know. But you think Hillary can withstand that?
I think the opposite. I think they tried a couple wet behind the ears types in George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and they might want somebody who's a little more seasoned and experienced this time around.
Well, I hope that's not Jeb.
And the Clinton years, the polls show the negatives on Jeb Bush much higher than Hillary's, and Hillary still shows positive matchups with just about everybody. Whereas Jeb does not. Jeb is way behind almost any other Republican. The question is, who is the other Republican? Now, in terms of Rolf's picking those top three, that's what Karl Rove wrote in a column just recently, and I think he's right. That's the top tier: Walker, Rubio, and Bush. And Bush, just because of the money, but with all the huge negatives, Karl Rove also called Trump an idiot and later on a moron. But on the other hand, I just heard Trump, you know, talking on the Morning Joe, and he's an interesting guy. I think he's more of a Ross Perot type of guy. So he could be a wild card. Might actually, I think he's a little smarter than Ross Perot, actually. So
that's an interesting comparison, because Ross Perot jumped into that race in, what was it, 92, specifically to make sure that Bush didn't win that election, because Perot hated Bush's guts because he knew that Bush was the world's biggest drug smuggler, that Bush had been involved in all sorts of dirty CIA dealings, including shipping back heroin in the corpses of American servicemen during Vietnam. So he was willing to spend his billion-dollar-plus fortune to make sure that Bush wasn't elected. He knew he would take away conservative votes and ensure that Bush lost in 92. And, of course, that's why Chip Tatum was then hired by Bush to, quote-unquote, neutralize Ross Perot, meaning kill him. And Chip turned that job down and got into a big mess. So here today we have something kind of similar with Donald Trump also jumping in, probably to try to deny the nomination to Bush.
Right, like Lindsey Graham is jumping in to try to deny the nomination to Rand Paul. So
and yeah, so you don't think Rand Paul has that good of a chance, because of course Rolf, despite these top three, you know, top tier candidates, he thinks that's a media scam. He thinks that Rand Paul actually is the best candidate and will quite possibly prevail.
Well, Ross, Rand Paul is the only one that has positive poll numbers against Hillary, but you know that's because he hasn't been fully attacked by right or left. And I think President Mondale would have been the poll result about a year before the Reagan-Mondale election, and that was a landslide in favor of the incumbent. Hillary's in that kind of position. I wouldn't take her negative polls all that seriously. But with Rand Paul, there is a chance that his problem is getting through the Republican primary.
Right. But, you know, up against Jeb Bush, Rand might not be, you know, facing such a hard time because, you know, Rand has that kind of fresh outsider look. Jeb is weighted down with all that baggage. But, of course, the Republican primaries are also very conservative. Jeb Bush has a whole bunch of sort of, you know, New World Order type of leanings that look sort of socialist to the base. So you would think that Rand could do okay against Bush in the primaries.
Bush, yeah, with the Common Core issue and weak on the immigration issue, Bush, Jeb definitely has problems, and it's you know, John Ellis Bush is J-E-B, Jeb, so Jeb is really just his initials. So he's been criticized for leaving out the last name, but that's his initials when he goes by.
Well, do we know that for sure? I mean, do we have a birth certificate?
I believe we do have a birth certificate in his case. But, you know, the interesting thing is that Rubio, you know, has that water drinking incident that, you know, when he opposed the State of the Union once, and that didn't look go over too well.
Wait, tell me about that. Water drinking incident.
Oh, He was giving the Republican response, and then he needed some water, and so he reached way over and leaned and grabbed a glass of water, or a bottle of water, I guess it was, and drank it and everything, and it just looked really strange. You know, he should have put that water right in front of him. He should have been ready to go.
So this is the way people decide who to vote for.
Well, it's kind of an interesting thing. And Walker, I think Walker is kind of a lightweight, you know, in foreign policy and so forth. Now, Jeb Bush is solid on the foreign policy, but he backed his brother's war, which is rather unpopular. And Trump makes that point. He says that Jeb took 5 or 6 days to get an answer on the war, and his answer is it was a terrible decision right off the bat. And he puts down politicals left and right and says, oh, there's a lot more talent and negotiators in New York than what the way they've negotiated trade treaties and lost out to the Chinese and so forth. And he says, and then he was questioned, well, can you negotiate with the Chinese? And he says, yeah, I've done deals with the Chinese. I can get along fine with them, even though I criticize them. And his thing is he just doesn't have the diplomatic skills of a typical politician. So he's a lot more like a Ross Perot in that way. He's got some good, powerful ideas, but some weaknesses. You know, that he just is not a polished professional politician.
But well, how about Scott Walker? Polished professional, but an empty cipher, it seems like.
Yeah, he's kind of an empty cipher, I think. I think Jeb's got too big of negatives, and Scott Walker is kind of an empty slate, and Rubio is a little bit of an empty slate, but not as bad as the other two. He might think slip through, but then again, if it came down to Rubio and Rand Paul, I think Rand Paul would have a chance there. You know, if everybody else is kind of knocked out of the race, because Rand Paul is going to be the little engine that could. He's going to hang on and hang on, and as the field winnows, he might actually find more Republican voters that say, you know, it's time for a real change, and I'm tired of both political parties. And there's a lot of sentiment that way for in the electorate in particular.
Well, there seems to be a lot of growing wave of populism in Europe. It's often manifesting itself as a kind of anti-EU, anti-globalist nationalism. There's a certain redistributive aspect, like in Greece. You could sum it up really as kind of ordinary people rebelling against this new world order of globalized corporatocracy. And here in the U.S., the candidates that would sort of represent that, I guess, would be Rand Paul and Bernie Sanders more than anyone else.
Well, that's the interesting thing. And also, Rand Paul goes for the black vote and stuff like that with decriminalizing drugs and getting people out of prisons for, these nonviolent crimes. That are sort of made up crimes like the drug issues and so forth, which is obviously changing in places like Colorado, Washington, and Oregon. I guess they've also passed the marijuana decriminalization there too. So it's changing, and medical marijuana is coming across all over the country, and I think people are tired of the drug war. As Jimmy Carter said, there are six times as many black males in prison today as when he was in office in the late 70s. So,
right.
So it's really gotten, the political spectrum has really swung wildly to one side, and crime has actually gone down. So why are we locking up all these people if there isn't all that much crime going on anymore? It's a very crazy, situation that seems like Hillary and Rand Paul are the only ones really taking advantage of that issue so far.
Well, if we're thinking about ending the drug war, at least to the point of legalizing marijuana, almost 50 years after the drug war began, it makes me wonder how long it'll take to end the war on terror, which is the current hysterical episode that's bringing in funding and rolling back civil liberties and leading to mass murders and other horrific consequences. Seems to me Rand Paul might be the guy who could end the war, not just the war on terror, but also the whole empire that is, the reason for that phony war on terror is to support this empire. You've done a lot of work on empire and military spending, and I wonder if just as it took a Nixon to go to China, it would take a kind of a perceived conservative Republican like Rand Paul to bring our troops home, not just from Iraq, Afghanistan, or what have you, but also from all of the military bases, maybe the 800 or more military bases all over the world, and become a normal country. You think that's something that could happen in our lifetimes?
I think it could. It's kind of like the British Empire letting go of India after World War II. Gandhi, of course, helped them along in that matter, but it was a logical thing. They had to let go of the empire and go with the Commonwealth and stuff, and that kind of a move would actually make a lot of sense for America. America is just throwing away their manufacturing sector, the scientists, engineers, and capital being wasted on destructive purposes rather than constructive purposes. When you put it in the military instead of in construction or infrastructure or manufacturing or crop producing or something else like that, where normally those kind of economic ingredients are employed, and it makes a huge difference. Are you gonna build or are you gonna destroy? You have a choice. Which way are you gonna go? And so if Rand Paul could get in there, he'd probably have a great economy, and then he could cut back on social programs because everybody'd have a job.
But wait a minute, Bob. How's that going to happen in today's climate where The U.S. has stopped manufacturing things. We're living on printing toilet paper dollars. They're only respected because we'll kill you if you don't take them. And even now, nobody's taking them. The Russians are jettisoning the dollar. The Chinese are following suit. The Russians and the Chinese are joining together to create a new economic zone that's going to become the new center of the world. And the U.S. Debt is going to, you know, crush us. So how could we have a booming economy under Rand Paul in just a few years?
Well, we actually grew the manufacturing economy in the 90s when we cut, even with the trade treaties, when we cut back on military spending from the 6.5% of GNP down to under 3% of GNP in a decade and a half after the peak of the Reagan military buildup. So the 80s was way high and the 90s was way low on military spending, and the prosperity went with the way low. You know, we doubled the economic growth rate of the 90s over the 80s. So it was a good move. And that's similar to what happened in the Kennedy administration in the 60s. I mean, that big boom of the 60s was going great guns until we got into the Vietnam War, and then that ended the long boom that was started by cutting the Eisenhower levels of military spending down to something a little more reasonable. 2% of GNP it dropped from 10% to 8% of GNP.
Well, you have to wonder, though, whether could Rand Paul really do such a drastic military budget cut? You know, is the president even really in charge anymore? We just had, you know, it looks like Ash Carter has moved in, taken over U.S. foreign policy in a sort of coup d'etat. Obama seems to be somewhat sidelined, and they're pushing for war on Russia. And would they really allow Rand Paul to do this?
Well, you know, Terry Reid's book suggests, you know, that the CIA runs the country, and that, you know, Clinton was tops on the CIA list when he was governor of Arkansas, and then the rest is history. And Obama had a secret past in the CIA as well, and working with Zbigniew Brzezinski in his first years out of office as a Columbia University professor, he was one of eight chosen students, and he got connected up there, and then did a couple stints in Pakistan, watching the Afghanistan war next door. So that's his foreign policy experience. And no wonder he got stuck in Afghanistan later on. And that plus he listened to the wrong advice, economic advice. Larry Summers attacked Seymour Melman, the guru of cutting military spending. He attacked him. He was the first questioner at an MIT speech, you know, and he probably counseled Barack Obama to keep troops in Afghanistan, because if you cut the military too much, you're going to lose too many jobs, and doesn't work that way. What it does is you make jobs where you put your talent, your engineers. They'll create jobs for you by, you know, the Steve Jobs way. I mean, Apple is now the biggest corporation on the stock market. It's far bigger than number two in the country. It's the new GM. Innovation is still king, and we've got a lot of talent, but we're just wasting it in the military, and we reassign it. We can regrow the manufacturing sector. It's down to 10% of the jobs, but there's still a lot of potential there. And the companies are coming back home. They're finding that you don't get the quality overseas, and they're coming back and forming here. And there's some of that going on already, and that can be enhanced when you cut the military.
Well, that's a very rosy view of the future. Somebody like Rand Paul taking over, cutting the military budget, surviving, not getting assassinated, and then...
That was Kennedy's problem. He got assassinated.
That was a problem.
But he did implement a pretty good cut that created a pretty healthy economy for a while. And then they got the Vietnam War, and that brought the end of that growth spurt of the 60s. But it had so much momentum, it took a few years of the Vietnam War to stall it. But it did. You know, there was the 66 credit crunch, and then there was the 70 recession, and then there was a big recession when we pulled out of Vietnam in 74 and 5. So there's a lot of, there's a tie-in. Every time you pull out of a war, the economy collapses in the short run. Because you've got that artificial stimulus. It's like an adrenaline burst, kind of like getting drunk the night before and then having a hangover the next morning. That's the way the economy operates in a war economy situation. And if you can't borrow your way through a war economy, you're in real trouble. Roosevelt was pretty good at it, though. Wilson and Lincoln had to pay people 5% interest on the war debt. He only paid them 2% interest and got all that war debt to fight World War II with. That was a pretty, he's a heck of a salesman.
Well, speaking of war debt, a lot of people would say that the real power behind the scenes is the international bankster cabal that creates wars precisely in order to run up war debt, funds both sides at interest, and then takes the compound interest forever and uses all of that free money that they get in that way to create all of these sort of, you know, parallel governance structures, deep state structures, IMF, the World Bank, all that stuff.
I get the drift. Here's what's going on with the bank situation. The bank situation in the Iron Triangle book, the banks that came out in 1981, the banks were interlocked with the defense contractors at the level of the average interlocks among all Fortune 500 companies, you know, at the 15% level. And that's pretty hefty tie-in just between those two industries. So they're in cahoots. You're right about that. And Citicorp, you know, was getting 60% of their profits overseas and had 7 of 15 directors linked with defense contractors. So, you know, yeah, there's even a bigger tie-in if you get your profits overseas. So, yeah, that corruption went on to get into all these trade treaties, selling out the manufacturing heartland in favor of the monetary and the military and the coastal economies, like the New York Stock Exchange economy and the military economy of Maryland and Virginia and other places. The Eastern Seaboard is a highly militarized area, and both coasts are highly into the service industry and if you're selling out the manufacturing heartland, that's not so bad for California either, because they can, the longshoremen make a lot of money unloading those goods from China and so forth, and sending them across the country along with the Imperial Valley's crops and so forth. They got a whole system going there, a distribution system that favors the East and West Coast. Service sector finance system that favors the East and West Coast, and a military system that favors the East and West Coast, and all of those aren't producing anything. They're not really producing the stuff that which the inland economy does. So we've gone from exploiting the Indians to exploiting Latin America with the Monroe Doctrine, to exploiting the world with the Iraq and the bringing the Monroe Doctrine worldwide with Bush and the invasion of Iraq and the Middle East. And meanwhile, what has happened? You know, we lost the steel industry in the 60s, and the auto industry came under assault in the 70s. The unions came under assault in the 80s. We had prosperity when we cut the military in half in the 90s. And then we went back to military buildups, and we had this the Great Recession results after driving everything crazy, driving the markets, the mortgage markets crazy because where the military is arbitrarily spent by the nation's politicians in a graft system where they get each other's votes and so forth. And the high military states people rise to the top of the congressional leadership and the presidential leadership and the cabinet and stuff like that, and even the Supreme Court. They dominate all levels of the system, and they are exploiting. Now they're exploiting us, the Midwesterners. The Midwestern part of the country gets exploited by the bicoastal economy.
Yeah, it seems like they've shut down.
One scam after another. Yeah. And the bankers, in the process of this, one more important point, the bankers have gone from, for their profits are 10 times their share of the economy they were in the 70s. 10 times. So the bankers have moved in and taken all the bright minds that would normally be in science and engineering, developing products and propelling the real economy forward. That's why they call it the Real Economy Institute. All those talented people are instead wasted on Wall Street, developing derivatives and credit default swaps and other crazy products like that, because there's 10 times as much profit now in the banking industry as there was 40 years ago. And that's as a share of the total economy. I mean, that's not counting inflation. That's including inflation, growth, everything. In other words, it's a bigger share of the total economy by 10 times. It's just outrageous what's going on. And that's squandering America's wealth, and it's creating a class society where we don't have social mobility like we once did, and people are feeling it. So I think, you know, there's a possibility there. Now, does it happen overnight? Well, it did in the 60s and the 90s. It really did. So I think you can start reassigning those resources, and America will start moving in the right direction.
Well, let's hope that people wake up and make it happen. I've been waiting for people to wake up to Building 7 for quite a few years now, and that hasn't happened, but maybe where their pocketbooks are concerned, they will be a little more discerning. Well, hey, Bob Roeschlein, I appreciate your great work. We're at the end of the interview, so let's send people to your website, realeconomy.com.
Right, and I have a variety of websites, so you can look at the links there, but the top two or three linkages at the top of the page are kind of the best, and you can work your way down and pick and choose, and there's a whole book's worth of material there if you want to read everything, or more. There's probably a couple books.
Including some really arcane topics, Condorcet wave cycles and things like that. We'll talk about that on a future show. Well, thank you so much, Bob Roeschlein.
Yeah,
keep up the good work.
Weather cycle is one of my most popular Google things, so.
Cool. Okay,
out.
We'll do another show on that down the line. All right, take care, Bob.
All right.
Bye.
All right, bye-bye.